Would you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Matt Law.
And are you in this thing? Is there some band?
I'm in a band called Low Moon.
Let's start with NYC. Where in NYC?
I grew up on Long Island.
Okay, where on Long Island?
So I grew up really in a
town. Yeah, and by the way, you were good. You didn't go Long Island. Most of the Japs do, yeah, right? Yeah.
I haven't heard that word used in a long time.
Oh, I heard
it. Oh, my God, that's amazing.
I'm still friends with some of them.
Me too.
Yeah.
I grew up in a town called Oyster Bay, home of Billy Joel.
I was just going to say, yeah. So did you go to the Italian restaurant?
I did, yeah, probably.
You probably did.
Yeah, probably did.
Right?
Yeah.
So NYC to LA, sophomore album. It's deeply personal.
Well, originally, I originally came out here like right after I graduated college.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Berklee College of Music.
Of course you did. But I imagine you were one of those people that sat and took the theory classes and said, yeah, it's good to know this, but I have absolutely no intention
playing
that stuff.
I got to be honest, even sometimes when I'm in the studio, I'm like, God, I should really know what the hell I'm doing here. And it takes me, you know, I have to think about it. It is that thing where I'm like, you want to learn it and forget it for sure.
I know.
Why I did it.
It's interesting, though, how many great musicians that have gone into popular music use the Berklee bedrock. It's ingrained in you no matter. The rules are there.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you go there with the intent to break the rules.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, it was the first time I'd been exposed to so many different artists in one place.
Right.
I think that I learned a lot about that. But to be honest, I mean, it was there. The education was just being around the artists. Just
isn't
being
that true, though? Right.
Oh, yeah. So when I left Berklee, I had two friends that had moved out here from Long Island, that had moved to LA, and they convinced me to move out here. And I came out for like a month and a half, and I absolutely hated it. And I was like, I have no point of being here. I'm going to move back. And I moved back to New York, and I lived with my sister in the East Village, and I was working at this studio called the Bunker Studio in Brooklyn.
Sure.
John Davis owned it.
Okay.
With this guy, Aaron Navizi, who were my two friends.
Got it.
And John actually went to the same high school as me. So I met him, but he was 4 years older than me. And I met him because his dad was the teacher at my high school. And John just took a liking to what I was doing and was getting into recorded music. So every time I would come home, he would record some demos for me. But anyway, I moved to New York and I worked at the studio and good learning experience. And then a friend of mine from Berklee called me one day and said, my friend Cyrus called me and he said, I have a friend named Andrew that you went to school with that you never met there, but he's an electronic producer and he really wants to get into kind of songwriting and he wants a singer to work on some stuff with him. And then we did. And that was kind of the start of Low Moon, because we wrote Loveless together. And then a manager out here heard it. This big bad story. Manager out here in LA heard it and was like, I'm moving you out to LA. We're going to get a record deal
in LA.
Was
that Pete?
That wasn't Pete. That was my first manager called Simon. And he was a great guy. And he came to New York and he said, you're going to move into LA, into my house. I just built this house. Whatever. We're going to sign a record there. And then, to be honest, we had a deal on the table with Capitol, with Harvest, and it fell through. And then I was kind of stuck
and
out
next,
here.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so that was how long before Columbia?
That was a year and a half before Columbia.
Wow.
And so I was out here starting to write. I had I'd kind of found myself in the songwriting scene. I was working with Dan Nigro, and I was working with Justin Raisin, and we were writing songs for what would become a Low Moon record, kind of.
Right.
We didn't really know yet.
Right.
And I had started playing around town. I had met Chris Santa and a drummer named Damar, and we were playing around town.
What happens here, though.
It's weird. I mean,
happen the same way in New York. It is different in New York.
It definitely is. It definitely is different in New York.
The scene is different.
Yeah. But I was kind of intimidated by the scene, to be honest, out here and in New York. Because I didn't really know where the music I was making fit into the scene, and I was kind of worried about that. But also, I think it led to me just going, whatever, I'm going to make my own music.
Yeah. I actually heard the record before I read about the record.
Oh, wow.
And then in prep for this, I read about the record. And the parallels between 9/11 and the pandemic is really wild to me. The thing about you seeing Springsteen hearing that song and saying, this gets inside me.
Mm-hmm.
This means something to me. That's been told, but that makes me think about this record and think, this has been in a record in the making for 13 years.
Wow, I've never thought about it like that. That's 100% true.
So you saw Springsteen.
So I saw Springsteen do My City of Ruins on the 9/11 tribute concert.
Right.
While I was still in high school. And I saw that and music just hit me completely differently. That was the first time I felt like, wow. And I was a sophomore in high school.
Wow.
And I loved music. I was obsessed with music. I played drums. I tried to sing in the Glee Club, but I wasn't very good at either of those things. But I never, ever, ever thought about writing music or writing my own songs. Ever. I never thought about it.
And then you wrote that first song.
I wrote this poem called A City Cries Its Tears.
Right.
That was basically like my way of expressing myself when 9/11 happened. And then I saw Springsteen do that. And I was like, well, I love music and I'm obsessed with music and I play drums. I never really play guitar, but I'm sure I could learn three chords. And what happened was I just started singing the poem that I had written to music. And that was it.
And next thing you know, you're doing the thing you never thought you'd be doing. You're playing it for people.
Exactly. Which I never in a million years expected that to happen, ever.
Which is both wonderful and creepy at the same time.
Yeah, it is. And right? And so that's why that's the parallel to the pandemic, because the first time I played the song was in this chapel and in front of the student body, and I had never sang a song in front of anybody by myself before, and I saw that it made me feel very connected to myself and the world in an emotional way.
And next thing you know, this becomes what you're doing.
I was recruited to play hockey, and hockey was my life. I played hockey every single day of my life from 7 to sophomore in high school, and I was obsessed with it, and I was recruited to play at this school, and before that school, I went to a school in New Hampshire that was an all-boys school that was a feeder program to the U.S. National Development Team. And I was gung-ho going to play hockey, Division I hockey in college. And that was my life goal.
So that's how you got to the infamous high school.
Exactly. I said to my dad, I actually really am in love with this thing now. And I started a band that year with my friends at high school, and we played at the Bitter End during Thanksgiving break. I booked a show at the Bitter End. It was the first time I played at a club. And like that all of a sudden became my existence was in the music room and then hockey practice. And somehow it just took over. And I give my parents a lot of credit for, they encouraged me to pursue this new passion that I had after having the same passion for, thinking back on it, like, it's kind of crazy that they did that. And my dad just said one thing. He said, if you want to do this, go learn as much as you can about this and get an education, because you pride yourself on your education, and go to music school if you really want to do it.
What was the lightning that happened in your brain that said, I want to go back?
I was just so over it. I was just so over the way that we had made the record, the second record of Modern Life. I was over the way everything that happened at Columbia
went down. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just over it. And I was really tired of thinking of music in a way that made me feel like it was no longer about the expression.
You had to make it. Yeah.
But exactly. It was about
the business.
The business and how people were going to react. And it started to make me feel strange about the thing that I had fallen in love with. And I said, I woke up one day and it was, I think the pandemic did that to everyone. Everyone reflected.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone sat at home and all we did all day was reflect. And I woke up one day and I called Sam in the band and I said, I'm going to go to this. And, Sam knew that I went to school in Connecticut. He didn't know how much that school had altered my career and my life. Yeah. And I said, I'm going to go back to the school and I'm going to put my phone down in this chapel and I'm going to see if I can write some songs. And he said, if that's going to make you feel better, then go do that.
Yeah.
And that's what I did.
And next thing you know, I'm going to do this backwards.
Cool.
My daughter graduated from Kenyon College.
Okay.
So you know
yep.
where I'm going
yep.
there.
Yep.
Commencement speeches.
Yep.
There's only two kinds.
The bad ones.
The bad ones and the ones that end up as David Foster Wallace, the maniac that he is, being an influence on this.
Yeah.
But so you do that. You have the line, you know, I wish you more than luck.
Mm-hmm.
But then, A, what was it about that hit you, that really got you inside? And then B, how did you decide to interpolate that and take that to the next level?
Well, the line, during the pandemic, I read a lot of Foster DFW. I read everything. And because I was obsessed with going back to my school, I read This Is Water, which was his, you know, his Kenyon College commencement speech that he gave in 2008. And, you know, it's kind of a reflection of life and the fact that life is an education. And that really, like, just that stuck with me. And then the last line when he says, I wish you way more than luck, I just read that and I was like, man, that's a song. And sometimes you read something and it just jumps at you and says that that's a song or that needs to be a line
right,
in the song.
Right.
And for me, that happened. And I tried to write, there was four failed songs before Water.
Wow.
And I
didn't hear that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, wow. Because I tried to write. And I remember I told Sam that I had this song title and he came over and we were jamming and like we wrote a song. I mean, there's three different songs with that title as the song.
Wow.
And one day we were in Seattle, well, Portland, sorry, working on this record and we started working on Water and it just, I was like, this is what this song is and it fit perfectly and it stuck.
So why was that the vibe? Why was that the sound? Other than it's MM's place, all that.
But that was really the only reason because we had a connection to the Modest Mouse world because Mike Davis, who was Chris Walla, who produced our first record,
right.
Assistant engineer, he really wanted to produce this record and we really wanted to produce it ourselves. And we thought, wow, let's have an engineer that we've worked with that we trust.
But you can take over the production.
Well I think we're, I will say, and I found this out now that we made three records, I think we're a very tough band to work with.
That's what I mean.
We are a very tough band to work with. There's
because you know a lot.
And you know what? And we know nothing at the same time. Well, I've just never met anybody who thinks they know everything. I've never met anybody who acts like that. I've never seen or heard anything great that they've ever made in their life. Ever. and no, that's a fact. If you actually think that you know everything, A, you're annoying to be around and nobody wants to hang out with you. And B, you're not learning enough because there is always something to know and always something to learn. And I think that with our band in particular in the studio, we're very obsessed with this thing called making records and it drives us all mad and everyone has their own kind of, and this for better or for worse, everyone has their own idea of what it should be. I'm less technical, even though I have the education about, I'm much less technical than probably everyone in the band really, but my technical superpower is I can really understand and put my finger on the feeling. And when the feeling is there, I'm the one that goes, it's done. And everyone kind of now, because we've made three records, does trust that I can do that.
You're willing to go with a vibe.
Yeah.
You're just willing to go, wait a minute, this thing's rolling and I'm at the top of the roller coaster and I know I'm going to go down and I know I'm going to go back up, but I don't know if I'm going to go down again or I'm going to go sideways right. or I'm going to fall off and die. I don't know, but that's what this record feels like to me.
Mm-hmm.
That you made a lot of decisions that were learned decisions on the fly, which yeah. seems like that sentence doesn't make sense.
Right.
But it does make sense.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there were a lot of songs on this record that did that. I would say Connecticut was one that happened like that. Water was another one that really came out of the sky. And if we weren't in a place where we could have let that happen and chase it down, then we wouldn't have done that. And actually, there's for every song on this record, there was a moment like that where, I mean, honest, I had that song lying around for since 2018, and I tried to track it for every record since. And not until we were up in the studio in Stinson Beach and I started playing this piano part completely differently did it snap into focus. And if we weren't giving ourselves the time and space to allow something like that to happen, then the record wouldn't have been made.
Where does this band fit in the world, and do you care?
No, I don't care. I've come to realize that I think one of the things that makes our band interesting and confusing to people, which is good, is that we don't make it easy to put us into the playlist of the world. And I call it the playlist of the world because that's how people are consuming music these days.
Oh, well.
And again, so it's, you know, we're not mood music, but we can be. We're not alternative rock, but we can be. And I think that, to be honest, I think it confuses people when they're like, what is that band? Oh, well, Water sounds like this, and Connecticut sounds like this, and this song's Talk Talk, and this is Peter Gabriel, and this is... And for me, I'm just like, no, this is the expression, the full expression of every band member and every single song has to be that. I don't let that get in the way. No, I don't think about it at all.
Back to the 2011 to now, we're talking about this record, isn't that the point?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, it's always the point, I guess, is to make something that makes you feel better, and it has to be cathartic, and sometimes that, for me, expressing it through music makes it surviving easier. Everything's easier.
But you don't set out to make a record for the times. You don't really, when you make these things, there's no predicated reason other than I'm making it, and wouldn't it be cool if people like it?
Yeah, I mean, of course you want people to like it. Yeah, of course. But yeah, I mean, I don't think we were ever set out. I don't know. I'm like, I talk about this a lot, but like, I don't need, I want to know that I have to make a record because something needs to be said. I don't want to make something that just because it fits a timeline or it's like somebody's saying we have to, or there's an obligation. Luckily enough, we're not in that position. We can just make records. Hopefully we can continue to do that. That's all I care about.
What is the filter for a Low Moon song? How do you know that it's a song for this band?
I think if my voice, to be honest, I think the guys would agree 100%. If my voice is able to fit in the song in a unique way that will take the, most of the time it's about the journey, about the journey of the song. And if my voice can hold that journey up, and then it's usually worth pursuing. If I'm connected to what I'm saying and what I'm hearing out of the speakers, it's usually worth saying. And then musically, we always talk about this oceanic feeling, which I think we don't really know what that is. It depends what record we're making, but I just go by the feeling of it. And sometimes it becomes very obvious, and sometimes it's completely... It's hidden underneath a bunch of layers. And sometimes you just have to peel back a few things, mute a few things, and go, oh, that's right.
Right? Isn't that fun?
It's really a crazy thing that happens when you're making records. But most of the time, I don't know how to explain it. Most of the time, I need to take a couple days off, and then I'll come back to it, and then I'll know.
And today, when you listen to it, did it accomplish what you wanted to accomplish?
This last record, I can say, was the first time that I felt like we made a record. Yes, it's our third record, but the first record has some moments on it that are that I love, that I think are amazing.
Right.
This record, I can say we set out to make something cohesive as a band, and it sounds to me like we did. And I listened to it for the first time in forever a couple of days ago when the record came out on last Friday, and I was like, I'm proud of this one. Like we really stuck to it.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich.
Okay.
And what it is two of your songs on the outside is the bread, and then anything you want to play in between.